Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I have the great pleasure of being joined by Mark Jenkins, Carlyle's Head of Global Credit, for a discussion about credit markets and the recently completed Global Credit Conference this week in New York. This episode was recorded on April 4th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Mark, just a word about what we're seeing in the economy. And I think that we're going to look back on the second quarter, or maybe all of 2025, based on a before and after. And of course, the before and after is with respect to what President Trump described as Liberation Day. And prior to Liberation Day, we saw evidence of slowing growth, but nothing like a sudden stop or, you know, abrupt contraction or some of the things that people had worried about or suggested may have been happening due to tariff uncertainty. People were still spending, you know, again, perhaps at somewhat slower rates than entering 2025. Businesses were still hiring, again, maybe at somewhat slower rates, but cumulative job growth had been solid. But we did see, of course, the fact that the uncertainty about tariffs did impose what you could think of as a compliance cost on businesses. Management teams were devoting lots and lots of time to thinking through their financial exposure, thinking through what sort of remedial steps they would take in the event of tariffs. After Liberation Day, I think it's pretty hard to know what to expect for the economy. And of course, markets have sold off pretty dramatically, I would say, since the announcement was made April 2nd at 4 p.m. And I think the sell-off is easy to explain in two ways. First, the average effective tariff rate, according to these policies, is much larger than what markets had anticipated. So last year, the U.S. imported $3.3 trillion worth of goods. They were subjected to an average effective tariff rate of about 2.4%. It looks as though under this new policy, and it's hard to calculate because there are exemptions for certain products like copper and semiconductors and pharmaceuticals. There's also exclusion for Canada and Mexico. So again, it requires some estimation. But it looks as though the effective tariff rate is going to be in a range of between 15 and 18%. So that's up quite dramatically from expectations. And rather than have it to deal with an implicit tax liabilities or an economic shock equal to about $300 billion, it looks like the economy, if these policies remain in place, will have to deal with a shock closer to maybe even $600 billion. That's annualized, again, implied tax liabilities. I would say that the second area where the market has been surprised was really the calculation of the tariffs. You know, we were told that these were going to be reciprocal tariffs, which is to say that the tariff rate that the U.S. would impose would be related to the tariff rates on those goods that were imposed by the U.S. trading partners. There was also discussion about also increasing the tariff rate in response to taxes, like border-adjusted value-added tax, to address any disparities there. So again, most of the planning had been done to look through these, you know, 10,000 product categories, get a sense of what the existing tariff rate was, what was being imposed by trading partners, and trying to estimate on that basis. Instead, the tariff rate was demonstrated to be simply a function of the U.S. trading partners' bilateral goods trade surplus with the United States. And so I think that, again, there is this, not just the size of the tariffs, but just the sense that the rates were simply calibrated to the size of the imbalance in trade. And so there was not really evidence of unfair trade practices or especially high tariff rates that could net some economies very high tariffs. And I think an example of this that is, you know, some people have pointed to, because it is interesting, is Bangladesh. And Bangladesh, because of its large goods trade surplus with the United States, was subjected to a 37% tariff. And This is hard to explain in terms of any market access issues or tariffs. The Commerce Department Ministry in Bangladesh estimates that the U.S. goods entering Bangladesh are subject to an average effective tariff rate of just 2.3%. So really, this is just a situation where Bangladesh has a large garment manufacturing sector. The median wage in Bangladesh is about $2,600 a year. And as a result, they export a lot of apparel to the United States. In fact, U.S. imports of Bangladesh almost entirely apparel and related categories. So again, I think not just the tariff rate, but a sense that the way it was calculated was some distance from the expectations in terms of the way the reciprocal tariffs were advertised. And I think that this has created enormous uncertainty, both about how the U.S. economy is going to absorb the shock, but also just questions about, is this really going to remain in place? Is this just some sort of placeholder with expectations of negotiations to come? It's really extremely hard to say. And again, I think given this elevated uncertainty and given the way it deviated from expectations, not terribly surprising to see that there's very few buyers relative to sellers in today's market. So, Mark, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me on today. Certainly an interesting time in the markets to be joining you.
I don't think we could have picked a harder day to be a guest, but I really do appreciate you coming on. And the first question I did want to ask, we just completed your global credit conference in New York, very well attended. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate. And I was just wondering if you could summarize some of your main takeaways from your interactions with investors.
Yes. Well, I mean, certainly the theme at the beginning that we spoke about with the investors was really this was a new environment of uncertainty that certainly is going to, you know, shape and form the economic environment going forward and the investment environment going forward. And we actually had that presentation and the whole conference the day before tariffs were announced. And I think we could probably, you know, paraphrasing Churchill, say we certainly, you know, this isn't the end of the uncertainty. It's just the beginning of the uncertainty. And I think what I mean by that is the uncertainty's happened. We have tariffs. We've been talking about that for such a long time and how they would be implemented, how big they, how severe they would be, and the duration. And I think we have answers on some, but not all of those. And the theme really from investors is how do we distinguish between what I would call noise versus the long-term secular trends that you and I have talked about very often. And I think we're just in this moment of time where investors are going to sit back and try to decipher what we should be doing, not necessarily in the next 3 to 6 months, but what it's going to look like 12, 24 months out. And that's very difficult to tell at this moment in time. And, you know, and I think investors are probably recognizing that today. You know, when I step back and say, well, what are the big secular trends? And they're the ones that you and I have talked about for a long time, maybe on this show as well, which is one, since COVID, we've seen basically reshoring, right? We've seen a redesign of supply chains. And then, you know, we've seen, you know, realignment of defense alliances. And that all is having a pretty significant impact on how people do business on, in the global marketplace. And certainly the impact or severity of the tariffs that have initially been put out there are going to have a big impact on that. But honestly, those trends are still in motion 12, 24 months ago. And they're just, I think more than anything, they're just amped up in intensity with respect to, you know, how people are building and redefining how they do business. And we're just trying to help investors navigate through that right now.
It was interesting. Last month, Matt Savino was the guest. And we were talking about, at that point, you know, the equity markets were really choppy. You didn't have the sort of drawdowns we've seen the past 2 days. But, you know, it was, you'd already were down, I think, 8% from all-time highs. But at that point, you really didn't see much in the way of spread widening. And credit, of course, we described as a canary in the coal mine. You know, if stock valuations can get out of whack, stocks can sell off, and it doesn't necessarily tell you all that much about the direction of economic activity. Credit spreads, on the contrary, generally do have, you know, pretty good predictive power, at least as far as financial market variables go. I imagine that the widening's been quite considerable, or would you just say it's like a cessation of activity? How would you characterize the credit markets today?
It's interesting. So I would say two things. One, and I think you've heard me say this, if you look back over 95 years of the S&P 500, 27% of the time has the market actually in any given year had annualized returns of over 20%. In the past 5 years, we've had three, or 60% of the time, we've had annualized equity returns in excess of 20, so twice as much as on historic levels. When you look at that, I think what the credit markets recognize is that we will only leverage to a certain amount. If equity goes to infinity, we're not leveraging to infinity, right? We leverage to cash flows. And I think in the past 24 months, what's really happened is corporate balance sheets have put themselves in a very good position. Leverage is basically back to pre-COVID levels. Interest coverage improving over that period of time, not quite to pre-COVID levels. A lot of the maturities have been pushed out, refinancing, et cetera. A lot of that has been done over the past 24 months. And equity valuations are going up in the public markets, but I don't think that credit markets necessarily would believe those. And so you've got this dramatic downshift, drawdown, if you will, on the equity side. But yesterday in particular, we did not see a very profound impact in the credit markets. You know, they were off half a point to a point, but really to kind of get back to what I call average spreads, you'd have to come down another point or two. We'll see what happens by the end of the day. But you're right, the market was more or less characterized by just no activity. Not necessarily any big sellers, you know, not necessarily any big bids out there, but we'll see over time what happens. Clearly, if this, you know, ripples through into what you and I talk about as being the real economy, let's see how tariffs impact the revenue line. Obviously, it's going to impact the cost line, but that's going to play out over many, many quarters, and it's too early to tell exactly what the impact is on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's too early to tell if this policy is going to remain in place. And I think that that adds just another element, that it, even if you were certain that these tariff rates were going to be in place for 3 or 6 months, it'd be challenging enough to estimate how the economy is going to absorb it. But of course, we also have to have some probability that this is ended, either because of negotiation or just because of the way the administration reacts, I think, to what the market is suggesting as it digests this news, which, again, is certainly interesting to contemplate. So in advance of the conference, we published a paper about back to basics. It was just looking at private credit markets. And I think, interestingly, focused on how private credit, you know, sometimes the growth draws attention. Sometimes it's mischaracterized. You know, I don't think it's really treated fairly in some ways. Mostly this is private credit displacing other forms of credit. So it's, you know, not really much in the way, if any, increase in overall leverage or leverage ratios. But it has been interesting to consider the extent to which the growth has been pretty much concentrated in this one area, which is dominated by sponsored M&A activity. You know, right. Essentially the direct lending, but a direct lending, again, in through the sponsored channel. And I was just wondering how you would, based on the paper or your own observations, how would you characterize the likely growth of the private credit markets going forward?
Well, I think what we've experienced, and you've pointed out to what I would call the leverage credit markets. Leverage credit markets or private credit markets, roughly call it 1.8, 2 trillion in size. And that has historically been, as you said, focused around equity sponsors, basically PE sponsors, buying companies, and us providing the private credit. And that will continue to grow or shrink depending on, you know, what happens in that part of the market. The area that has opened up dramatically and has given, you know, institutional investors in particular access to assets that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to invest in is what I call the private IG and asset-backed market. And that market itself is, you know, it could be estimated to be 20 to 40 trillion. I think here at Carlyle, we estimate it to be around 23 trillion of opportunity versus roughly the 2 trillion in the leverage side. And why has that happened? I mean, it's happened for a number of reasons, but predominantly as banks have basically moved towards being more, I hate to use the word asset light, but fee focused. There's been some regulatory movements, obviously, over the past 15 years. There's also been some regulatory accounting issues as well that have made certain assets that they traditionally have held on their balance sheet not as efficient to hold, but they still want to maintain that client relationship. So, for example, student loans, great example of an asset that, from an RWA perspective, aren't that efficient for banks to hold anymore, but have been historically well-analyzed, well-studied assets. And now people like ourselves are buying those loans, repackaging, holding certain aspects of that. And it's just opened up a whole new area of investment on the private side that has traditionally been held by financial institutions and non-financial institutions. that's opening up to institutions. And that really is driving a big part of the growth. The leveraged credit side will continue to grow and is estimated to grow somewhere between 10 to 15% annually. And we'll always be participating in that. But what I think this new aspect or new element that's opening up allows investors to be diversified away from pure single name corporate risk, which is what you take, you know, more or less on the leveraged credit side.
The we talk about the need to serve both investors and investees. You know, investors, obviously, private credit, it's about illiquidity premium. You're generating 200-300 basis points. I mean, sometimes more depending on the market category for the same level of credit risk. But of course, that then begs the question, how are you serving the investee? What is attractive about private credit that actually makes it so people are willing to pay somewhat higher cost of capital?
Yeah, so from the borrower's perspective, I mean, it's kind of two things. One is ultimately you're providing a tailored solution that you can't just get in the regular way capital markets. Because if you think of like a regular way loan, a regular way high yield, it's a very standardized package for your financing needs. And as companies have become larger, and frankly, there's more companies staying private for longer, as you know, Jason, you know, people need that alternative form of private capital to grow that allows them a lot more flexibility as they're pursuing either their capital or their growth needs over time. So that's the kind of main attractiveness that people are willing to pay up for. Now, over time, if those companies, if you will, can become more efficient, i.e. have different reporting that are required for doing a high yield bond or a loan, then they will naturally move into the capital markets. And it may at times be more efficient for them than the private markets. But those two markets, by the way, over the past, I'd say 5 years, have really converged. And what it does is it's an ecosystem that offers borrowers the opportunity to look for where the best relative value is. And it's not always price, but it's the terms and conditions of that loan that they're putting in place to help them achieve their capital raising outcome, if you will.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And I do think it does feel to me, at least in some places, you know, you private markets, there are always circumstances where, you know, you wonder if the fund flows or interest are calibrated the opportunity set. And it seems to me, just from our study, this is a situation where it's almost quite the opposite, where the opportunity set is so far in excess, in fact, orders of magnitude larger than the actual funds that are seeking opportunities in the space. Well, thank you very much for joining me again on a day of pervasive uncertainty. And again, lots more sellers than there are buyers in our equity market. But I was somewhat reassured by our conversation, Mark. So I thank you very much for that.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens in another week from now. Maybe we'll have a different conversation. Thanks, yep. Jason.
Thanks again.
All right. Take care.
Well, thanks again, Mark. And as always, thank you for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights and Indicators.